So I finally came out and told my daughter, my 19-year-old, that I smoke weed. She took it pretty candidly and just said that, yeah, I kind of figured that based on the, you had a podcast dedicated entirely to the time you took mushrooms. So I, well done. Checkmate. The UCLA Bruin comes through. That education's finally paying off. Hello and welcome back. And so today is the day after the recall, and evidently people forgot the lyrics of that great Who song, Won't Get Fooled Again. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. You know, it's that whole thing about trying to find that new leader, that new person that's going to lead the way for us. And not that I'm a big fan of Newsom, I'm not at all. He is a protege of Slick Willie Brown, and he's also a hypocrite, and he has that air of entitlement. He's got a very entitlement whiff floating around him, much like the owner of the dealership I used to work for, this guy Brent Gardner. Just, you know, they're kind of, they have the same vibe, one and the same. This kind of like, you know, people just blowing smoke up your ass most of the day, which they are fully aware of, yet still, you know, walk around in this formation of entitlement, and it's gross. And but if we would have replaced him, it would have been the same deal. It made me think of the time that back in 2003, the last recall we had, when they pushed Gray Davis out and brought in Arnold, and I had to take a step back when I was standing in the middle of downtown Modesto watching Arnold Schwarzenegger get off a bus while he was campaigning for governor of California. So, A, why am I in Modesto listening to Arnold Schwarzenegger give a speech in, of all places, Modesto, for, of all things, a California governor recall speech where he was running for the title of governor of California, which, come to find out, he flew between campaign stops and then would jump on the bus before they entered the plaza wherever he was going to speak, as a sign of, you know, or as a show of, like, you know, that I'm one of you. I'm on this campaign bus. I decided I could ride a bus like all you normal scumbags, you know. So, and what did that do for us? Well, it didn't really change the EKG line on the old state of California any other direction. It just kind of came and went. They just wanted the new boss, but he was the same as the old boss. And here we are, right back where we started, kind of didn't learn a thing. Now we got this this retard in office that you know, can go to the French Laundry whenever he damn well feels like it. But oh well, that's just the state of politics. That's why they don't speak for me. Neither side speaks for me. I think politics are a function unto themselves. Without judgment, I'm going to say that anybody that really, you know, they just the type of people that they drag into or empower into a parasitic fashion, these parasites that show up, like, good example is like people that make you cringe, like Candace Owens or Tomi Lahren, these people that are just kind of like manipulated by the powers that be for the hot button topics at the time. they bring in these parasites that just are gross people, because that to them is their whole existence, is this, you know, partisan politics, identity politics. It's very identity politics, which is now more so popular than ever. So it's just gross in every way, and it's diluting our culture. It's diluting our diversity, and it's really just, you know, creating an us versus them mentality, and that's sad, and it shouldn't be that way. And that's all I'm gonna say about it, because I don't give a fuck who's running this show. I'm an anarchist, bitch. So moving on, back to the initial opening intro. All my kids have what I would assume to be a different perspective on everything, including the fact that I smoke. My youngest would probably be the one that would be vehemently opposed, due in part to her weirdly incredulous moral stance on things, even though she's a future, like, theater producer, actress, theater arts, mime, indulging, RuPaul watching, what's that show? RuPaul's, Drag Race? Whatever the... Yeah, I've seen it. It's great. What's the name of the one? There's one of them that's, God, there's one that got the best name of all. I gotta pull that show up and see what the, it's, oh man, there's some outrageous types on that show, but, too much, a little too much. But it's fun to sit there and watch when your kid's really into it and wonder why. Well, okay. That's cool, man. Like, you know, let your freak flag fly, whatever floats your boat. But I would think I think we would be stronger as a society with a little more diversity. As long as it's an open-ended communication, okay? So, I mean, I certainly don't want a dozen of me running around. That's for sure. But one of my favorite, I guess if we're talking counterculture, one of my favorite counterculture figures is the late great Ken Kesey, who he is the author, the writer of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And what his deal was, one of my great stories I like to recall and retell, because there was so much going on at the time, back in the 60s, early 60s, in Palo Alto, in Stanford. This guy Kesey, he graduated from University of Oregon, and he got a writing fellowship down to at Stanford. And they basically, what they did was they put him up on campus, or in this let's see, what the hell, what was the name of the place? It was called, it was, it was, hold on, folks, be patient. It was... Perry Lane, that's right, Perry Lane. So he lived in this area, this place, Perry Lane, and a neighbor of his, this Stanford psychology graduate student, his name was Vic Lavelle, talked him into volunteering to take part in what turned out to be the CIA finance study under the title Project MK Ultra, which just got a lot of notoriety recently based on the book Chaos by Ed O'Neill about the CIA involvement in the MK Ultra experiments, where they dosed the general population unbeknownst to them, unwittingly dosed, you know, regular people in society in an effort to gain mind control. And ultimately, one of their most high profile subjects was Charles Manson, who in turn was indoctrinated into the MKUltra CIA's program, this highly secret military program, and then eventually led to his use of the drug LSD, and then his use of LSD on his followers to gain their mind control in an effort to put a criminal element into the anti-war efforts they're seen by Richard Nixon as that he wanted to vilify the hippies and the anti-war protesters through the use of this mind control. And Manson was the perfect component, the perfect weather vane for this, to be seen as this malevolent character that pretty much brought the 60s to an end in a series of all these killings that happened on Cielo Drive and in Hollywood and in the neighboring areas, painting the anti-war movement as dangerous and drug-addled, okay? So the genesis of this whole project started in Palo Alto in Stanford with the psychology graduate class that basically were neighbors with this guy Ken Kesey, who hadn't written One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest yet. But at the Menlo Park VA, where Kesey worked as a janitor, he would take this acid, he would take LSD. Well, there was the project studied the effects of like psychedelic drugs like LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, DMT, just some real heavy duty shit on their subjects that were paid. That's how, and Kesey did this kind of as a supplementary income situation. So at night when he worked at the VA hospital in Menlo Park, he would have these visions of an Indian, and they just kept having these recurring visions of an Indian. So that was kind of the beginning of how he started writing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because the book is told from the Indian's perspective. In the movie, it's kind of a third-person omniscient. There really isn't a narrator. The Indian is a character in the movie, but in the book, it's the narrative is done through the eyes of the Indian. Okay? So while working on the night shift at the VA there, he would often spend time talking to the patients as well, sometimes under the influence of these drugs like LSD that he volunteered to experiment with. And in so doing, I don't know if it was in conjunction with the LSD or just his personal perspective, Kesey didn't believe that these patients were insane, maybe not all of them, but rather that society had pushed them out because they did not fit the conventional ideas of how people were supposed to act and behave. So that was the inspiration for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So the book came out in 1963, was adapted into the movie. Well, first it was done as a stage play, and it was optioned by Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas played R.P. McMurphy, Jack Nicholson's character in the movie, And what was interesting in the character Randall Patrick McMurphy, the character McMurphy, RPM, that was a specific literary tool that Kesey used RPM because of the amount of momentum and the amount of energy that this guy created, this guy McMurphy, this fictional character. But so Kirk Douglas, Michael Douglas's father, played McMurphy in the theatrical production. But when it was adapted into a movie, Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son, was one of the producers, along with the great director Milos Forman, who also did like Amadeus. He also did Man on the Moon, the Andy Kaufman biopic with Jim Carrey. Great director, did the screen adaptation, and they won, like, they swept the Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, blah blah blah. But Kesey got a little bitter over he didn't get paid much for the. Well, he said he'd never seen the movie because of a dispute over the amount he was paid for the film rights, but more specifically, I think I'd like the book because the film was not narrated by the Chief Bromden character. He disagreed with Jack Nicholson being cast as Randall McMurphy. He wanted Gene Hackman. There you go. See, Gene Hackman. But who could you picture? You couldn't picture anybody else doing that. I think Kesey had to, like, take a step back and kind of, like, begrudgingly kind of agree that was... I mean, Hackman probably would have been a great fit as well, but Nicholson, I mean, you just can't picture anybody else doing it. But overall, I mean, he was generally supportive of the film, but the film was brilliant. Shot up in Oregon, where Kesey was from. He was born in Colorado, but he was raised in Oregon. He went to University of Oregon. He's straight Oregon stock. Kesey is that guy, that meld of he considered himself too old to be a beatnik, too young to be a hippie. But he's very much redneck stock, and like Oregon itself, this kind of confluence of hippie and redneck and I mean, like the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead, with it's like there's this ever-present continual confluence and convergence of kind of this back hills bluegrass redneck sensibility married and or intertwined with this hippie ideology. This beatnik ideology, which is ever, or the like in the foothill towns around here, Placerville, Grass Valley, there's this continual, again, this convergence, this melting pot of sensibilities that are integrating, subtly integrating. I mean, there's some places that still stand out, obviously, that with one particular ideology. There are some place. Auburn is very strictly, I would say, redneck. Folsom, very much, Blue Lives Matter, white, basic bitch, suburban housewife, type women floating around there. Bunch of Karens. It's a lot like what D.H. Lawrence said of Paris. It's a beautiful, beautiful place if it weren't for the Parisians. Same goes with Folsom. It's a brilliant place. It's got the highest concentration of water, bodies of water per capita than anywhere in the tri-state area or U.S. I mean, it's with its wet. It's got marshland still. It's got wetlands. It's got the Folsom Lake, the reservoir. It's got the river. It's got a the area is beautiful, and the past is like back in high school, like, there was literally nothing there. If when I was there, when I would just do random drives out there, and when I would, when I was asked, you know, where'd you go? What are you doing? Or where are you at? And I'd say, well, I was in Folsom. They'd be like, well, what happened? You get lost? Like, there was nothing out there. And now it seems to have been settled by, kind of the Cracker Barrel crowd, and that's cool, whatever. But the divergence of adversity, Placerville, Grass Valley, the flannel wearing hippies meet the flannel wearing bohemians. And I always forget what do they call the new bohemian guys with the beards. But anyway, they're all up there. They seem to be getting along. But that's what the Grateful Dead are. Why do I bring up the Grateful Dead? I'll tell you why. Well, because I'm really getting into them now all of a sudden. But also, they were the house band. Okay, so the story goes, when Kesey was in Palo Alto under this Stanford Fellowship writing, taking acid under MK Ultra CIA-backed fucking experiments, there was a band out there, just a kick-around band hanging out, full of these kind of dirty hippie looking guys. One guy, this guy named Jerry Garcia, and some of his buddies would play out there, and then Kesey would get all this acid, take this acid and bring it back and have parties in after the success of the book, after he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, after the success and then the eventual kind of migration of him and his new community of these people, they all kind of migrated to about 15 minutes west in this town called La Honda, just outside of Palo Alto. And he would have these LSD kind of, I don't know what they were acid tests. They were basically raves. They were the beginning of raves. And it was all documented in the book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is one of I keep forgetting how great a book that is. It's the new journalism back in the 60s and 70s when guys like Hunter S. Thompson and this guy Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, were coming out of the woodwork with the new journal. New journalism basically is like nonfiction fiction. Okay, so it reads like fiction, but it's real stuff, because these were the beginning of these embedded journalists, these types that, like Hunter S. Thompson, who rode with the Hell's Angels in the same area. Matter of fact, a lot of the, a lot of what was happening with these acid tests were documented in Thompson's book, Hell's Angels, part of it. And then, but then Tom Wolfe, this guy who was a brilliant, brilliant journalist and writer who wore a three-piece suit everywhere for some reason, he did this book based on this crazy kind of cultish group of weirdos who called themselves the Merry Pranksters, coming out from the Perry Lane neighborhood and then ultimately settling in to this area in La Honda, about 15 minutes away. He decided he would hang out with these guys. It was kind of this little rustic hamlet in the Santa Cruz Mountains, west of Stanford there. And so Kesey would entertain friends and others at these parties, these acid tests. And the house band was this band, the Grateful Dead, who originally started out as the Warlocks, but they eventually evolved into what was now the Grateful Dead. But they did the whole black light thing, fluorescent paint, strobe lights, other psychedelic effects. Allen Ginsberg hung out there. But all the stuff in Tom Wolfe's book was brilliant. So, and then eventually, see, he wrote, and then again, the other firsthand accounts of the acid test came with Thompson's book, The Hell's Angels, The Strange and Terrible Saga of the Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs, which is, that's a phenomenal book too, but all this stuff happened there in La Honda. And so when Kesey wrote his second book, Sometimes a Great Notion, that afforded him this, he bought this bus, and on the front of the bus he put the moniker up above the window. It's called, he called the bus Further, F-U-R-T-H-U-R, and basically he loaded, so he wanted to do this tour across the U.S. and so everybody, they kind of loaded up on this bus, him, the Merry Pranksters, Neil Cassidy, who is the one of the main figures in On the Road by Jack Kerouac, was the guy driving the bus. So all this kind of literary kind of mythology surrounded this stuff. So gaining the financial success of the second book, Sometimes a Great Notion, they wanted, okay, he molded that together with this trip that was supposed to go to New York. He had to go to New York. I think he wanted to go just check out the stage adaptation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he thought, well, what greater opportunity would this be than to just everybody hop onto this bus? Tom Wolfe included. Amongst all these hippies, you know, these counterculture figures, Neil Cassidy, Ken Kesey, was this guy Tom Wolfe wearing this three-piece suit with all these hippies. And they captured a lot of it on film. But the idea is, was that he would go east and turn it into like this road trip. And then along the way, they would perform these acid. They would basically be performing these raves, you know. And because in an interview after arriving in New York, Kesey was quoted as saying, the sense of communication in this country had damn near atrophied. But we found as we went along, it got easier to make contact with people. If people could just understand, it's possible to be different without being a threat. So very, in my opinion, very eloquently put. But that was the whole impetus. Once they got out to the East Coast, that's where, you know, Kesey met Jack Kerouac. I mean, just these two great counterculture figureheads. Kerouac, not as much. He was definitely a sought-after literary character. I don't know, counterculture-wise, he was just a guy. He was just a guy that was kind of bumming across the U.S., hitchhiking, taking trains, you know, hanging out with bums, hanging out with writers, poets, visionaries, shamans, weirdos, beatniks, freaks, hippies. He didn't give a fuck. He was a drunk, you know? He was just a guy that enjoyed just hopping a train and just heading for wherever it took him. You know, but he wrote that fucking great great book, On the Road. I highly recommend to anybody, which, in a way, I mean, it certainly is very stream of consciousness. Truman Capote kind of shit on it, saying he didn't call it writing, he called it typing. But fuck Truman Capote, that little sawed off little dick. Nobody really talks about his shit anymore, do they? Huh? Although, I heard In Cold Blood was pretty good. But anyway, moving on. So Kesey, you know, made his way out to the East Coast, where he also ran into, like, Timothy Leary. you know, all these kind of shamanistic types. You know, Leary was this great psychiatric professor, Harvard professor, taught psychology I believe psychology at Harvard. And kind of went on the same journey, kind of in a different vein as Kesey, but did the same kind of preaching of the or espousing the benefits of LSD to the point where they incarcerated him. But what was funny is he created this Timothy Leary, the Harvard professor who loved LSD, created the psychological test within the criminal penal system where he was incarcerated for LSD. He created the psychological test that determined whether you were criminally insane or not. So obviously he passed it. And then he escaped. So, fuck it. But Kesey was just this guy, you know, I consider him, well, he's a legend. And he was, in essence, he was the facilitator of the Grateful Dead. So I got into this new, podcast about the Grateful Dead, and it's really, really well done. And there's so many influences brought up alongside the podcast that contributed or were influenced by Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. But one of the initial quotes that I got, or that he, that Jerry Garcia was, what he'd mentioned was, being in that band, he was with a group of people that were much like him, that were, it was impossible for them to create the same exact thing twice. That's why they were more of a jam band. Or if that wasn't his words, that's more everyone else's take on it. Like, so it really, you know, you could see where modern day versions I would consider like Sublime, Fish, you know, those guys, jam bands, but you don't want to hear the same thing twice. You don't want, again, it's like that diversity that you crave. And it's like an NFT. This new thing with NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And how I remember that acronym, I'll never know. Probably the fact that I smoke weed. So take that, Audrey. But the NFTs, non-fungible tokens, are basically a digital capture of an event that will never happen again, okay? Much like the Grateful Dead music, any lick, any chord, any riff will never probably be played repeatedly or in the same vein as the original conception. Okay, so the NFT, the idea is, say it's a picture of dogs playing poker. It's an NFT of picture, a digital picture of dogs playing poker. Or the brush strokes within that, or the fibers within that velvet painting of Elvis. You know, the way the wind catches the velvet fibers and blows them in a certain direction, or the way that the brush strokes on, say, Van Gogh's irises, which are now at the Getty Museum. Or his, you know, or Jackson Pollock's blue poles at the Australian National Museum. There will be only one time that that brushstroke will ever be in that longitude and latitude of that painting ever again. That's why art is expensive, because it will never be recreated. Even the duplicates are, even the duplications have a divergence at some point. You know, cartographically, map-wise, on the picture, or the painting, or the digital, you know, that's why capturing something digitally in its, you know, in its only state ever is what adds to the value of the NFTs. Alongside that value, you create alongside great art. That's why blue poles sold for like 30 million. Or irises sold for whatever it did, 20 million, 30 million, whatever. It will never be duplicated again. you know? And there's a brilliance in that. That's what diversity is. You'll never have the same nuance again. It's a constant refreshing take and a constant new stimuli. So with that, it creates value. But anyway, I'm gonna pause here just for a second, and I'll be right back. Bob the Drag Queen. That's who I was trying to remember. I got sidetracked. My ADHD, my supposed adult ADHD kicked in and I lost concentration. But Bob the Drag Queen, one of my favorite contestants on RuPaul's Drag Race. This black dude with like a giant, like, it looks like the biggest afro you've ever seen. Like the size of one of those inflatable like balls that you jump in and then you run down a hill. And anyway, Bob the Drag Queen. But getting back to, see, I got an issue with concentration and I forgot I had a job to do. So I got distracted and I had to go in and I had to take care of some stuff pertaining to, you know, donated organs and platelets and stuff like that. But oddly enough, this morning I was listening to Dr. Andrew Huberman. I love this guy, Dr. Andrew Huberman. I love this motherfucker. His podcast is so straightforward, and it's not densely worded with scientific nomenclature that it's just too dense to digest. Like, he really scales it down. He doesn't dumb it down. He just gives it to you kind of in layman's terms. But the subject matter, the one that I listened to this morning, was about ADHD. I can't concentrate. But so as a professor of neurobiology at Stanford, here we go, you know, something about the water in Stanford, you know, if there's something in the water there in Palo Alto, it inspires greatness amongst the scientific, literary, and musical communities, evidently. But one thing, so what he was talking about, and it kind of has a link up or a, again, I'm talking in disparate parts, in regard to things that are, this will all make sense at one point. So, but what he was talking about was ADHD in regard to the prefrontal cortex and the drugs that are used to administer them. Back in the day it was Ritalin, now it's Adderall. But what it is in essence, one of the things that he cited was a dopamine, one theory anyway, in regard to ADHD. Well, let me back up just a sec. Okay, so what he's saying is there's three parts of the brain: the dorsal lateral prefrontal lobe, the posterior cingulate cortex, and the lateral parietal section, that all three play together. But in ADHD, they aren't playing well together. Okay? So there's three, with these three, within these three sections of the brain, we also have these, they're called default mode networks, and they act in a correlated fashion in an ADHD situation. In normal situations, they are, what was the expression that he used? They are anti, they're anti-correlated, okay? So among the default mode network in your brain is what you're using as you're driving, okay? Because you're not, you are paying attention, but you're really not, because you're thinking about stuff, or you're listening to the radio, you're listening to this podcast, or you're thinking about your groceries, picking up stuff at the store, whatever. Okay, and then the other portion is the task networks. The task networks in your brain, within these three sections of your brain, are what your brain engages you to scratch an itch, or avoid picking at something that you don't want to pick, something deliberate. And so in an ADHD brain, they're more correlated than they are in a normal brain. In a normal brain, these are all anti-correlated systems, okay? So they're all supposed to communicate with each other. The dorsal lateral prefrontal lobe, the posterior cingulate cortex, and the lateral parietal section all are supposed to play together like a band, like a symphony, like a lead guitar, bass, and drummer. So if it's disjointed, it's supposed to be disjointed. So when they start working in conjunction with each other, that is a symptom of ADHD, but there's still something off. They just work more in correlation. It was kind of confusing, and I had to re-listen to what he was saying. But in essence, so the theory of the low dopamine situation. So, okay, you're going to get dopamine, say, if you're, if you're in an ADHD situation, you'll get dopamine from certain drugs, like at a base level, it'd be like coffee or sugar, just straight sugar. And what that does is it gives you a little dose of dopamine, and the dopamine wakes up the little conductor in your brain who starts conducting this orchestra of the three sections of your brain and making them work in conjunction with one another. More so than they would otherwise. So other drugs that he cited, though, of course, were like more stimulants, you know, cocaine, amphetamines, even the abuse of non-prescribed Adderall, which is right up there with people that take recreational drugs like smoke weed or mushrooms or psilocybin stimuli, LSD mushrooms, which, by the way, have just been the California Assembly just decriminalized all the psilocybin mushrooms, mescaline. Even the harder ones, I believe, it just has to pass through the Senate now to become law, but pretty soon that will all be, like you'll just walk into, like you're walking into, Noah's Bagels to get a bag of mushrooms. Just like you walk into a shop right now to get weed, which we all need. I think we need that. I think we need it. I think we've been overstimulated too long with a Starbucks every 30 yards, with ingesting 500 milligrams of caffeine in one shot has made us all insane. And so I think the proliferation of these weed stores, and now, soon within, within the year, or even within a couple years, you start going to buy retail mushrooms, we're all going to have a nice, calm, relaxing mode, and all of our loose synapses that are just firing random neuron charges into our brain and disrupting this effect of cohesion will soon be jointed as opposed to disjointed. I mean, why do they call it a joint, for God's sakes? But anyway, so So how this relates to what I've been talking about, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you because I... So backtracking a little, getting back to like Stanford, Ken Kesey, and the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead, based upon now my own findings, are this slow burn. You know, what's the typical reaction that you hear with the Grateful Dead? I don't get it. You need to be on drugs to understand it or to dig it or to get into it. Well, that in fact is the case. What in essence is happening is, okay, so I was listening to the other podcast today, this Grateful Dead podcast. There's this guy, Steve Bernstein, who played with them or was in that musical scene, and he was commenting on Jerry Garcia's playing in particular, obviously, and the disjointed way that he played relating to a kind of jazz blues gospel dissonance, which is what it was. That's what they are. It's that slow burn, because you can't pick up, you can't trace the element of narrative within each of any of their songs or albums. Because it's this amalgamation, this blend of everything, okay? So it's like you are relying on your dorsal lateral prefrontal lobe as your lead guitar, your posterior cingulate cortex as your bass, and then the lateral parietal section being the percussion, the drummer. And all three have to play together. So what this guy Bernstein was saying, and he seems to know what he's talking about, is the way Jerry Garcia, this kook who kind of borrowed from bluegrass, from jazz, he played with Ornette Coleman, the basic blues themselves, the gospel, very little just straight rock and roll. Well, that all kind of was put into this mixture of what became the Grateful Dead. So if you decide you want to be a student of the Dead, good luck, because you really got your work cut out for you, because it's a very multi-layered, for what I'm gathering, a very multi-layered sound. I'm a novice with music. I couldn't carry a note in a bucket, and I can't play, I can play the skin flute, but that's about it. But what he does, what Jerry Garcia, according to this guy, Steve Bernstein, who was basically educated as a jazz percussionist, said that he uses the climbing scales out of order, okay? So in kind of gearing up and getting ready to play or to get into a song or to use it as a framework for a song, he'll be climbing scales out of order. Do, re, fa, sol, la, ti, but out of order, and then reversing the order, doing it out of order, and then out of sequence, and then reversing that sequence to hit a weird kind of, and then hitting a weird kind of chromatic climb thing to get a little dissonance, and then come back to a chord shape to bring it back in, basically combining all three things at once and move through them. But he does this all subconsciously, not aware that he's actually doing it. It's, which makes for, it appears he's not cognizant of it. He may not be. He could be. The amount of practice that these guys, all they did was play. Well, and take mushrooms, and acid, and smoke weed. But it all, again, it's this convergence of these dissonant tones that come together. But then when it's executed, it's done subconsciously. Very much like in the end of, like, say, for, Unforgiven with Gene Hackman. But it's a part where one of my favorite parts. I just watched this out at Laguna de Balsac out there. Some people came out from Aptos and set up this outdoor movie theater, and we watched Unforgiven. It was like a nude mystery science theater outdoor. It was like an outdoor nude mystery science theater event where we sat and watched Unforgiven and with Clint Eastwood. Fucking great movie. Like, you can't even call it a Western. It's art, man. But in the end, where he shoots everybody up and, you know, Gene Hackman gives him the line, you know, like, you just shot an unarmed man. And then Clint Eastwood goes, well, he should have armed himself. Fucking great line. But then when the whole gunfight goes off and he just levels everybody except for the writer, and, you know, the writer that was documenting English Bob's traveling and so forth in the beginning of the movie, he you know, this guy climbs out from under a couple of dead bodies, and he asks him, like, how did you know who to shoot first? I get it, you shot the guy by the door first because you needed to, you know, because he was the strong arm, and then you went to the guy with the pistols, and, you know, there's a whole methodology. He's asking him this, how did you know which to go to first? And Clint Eastwood was just like, I didn't know. I just started firing, you know? Like, well, that's how it probably comes off with listening to Jerry Garcia. You're there to dig this bluegrass folk, you know, jazzy jam band with a head full of mushrooms, and the mushrooms, which are raising your dopamine levels to this brilliant symbiosis of your three sections of your brain, the dorsal lateral prefrontal lobe, posterior cingulate cortex, and then the lateral parietal section. You're raising all these up with that little mini conductor. That little mini conductor is the dopamine. And the dopamine starts, he gets out his little conductor wand, and he goes, okay, you come in now. And then he goes over to the other guy. You come in now, right? And that's what's happening at a dead show. And the reason it's happening at a dead show is because of, acid. LSD. And, it just kind of harmonizes everything for you. So that's kind of my take on it. I don't know. What do you think? Oh, and another thing he said, Huberman talked about was, when you're blinking, okay. And this is all, of course, related to the neurobiology. As an aside, not necessarily in conjunction with, but as a just form of what your system is partaking in. I found it fascinating when he says the blinking you do regulates the amount of information entering your system, according to Dr. Andrew Huberman. So the people that you run into that are blinking super fast, like they just, you know, like I trip out on those people. I got friends like that, they go through sequences of like triple blink 4, 5, 6 in a row, boom, boom. Or maybe it's just a routine kind of blink, 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 but real deliberate, almost looks forced. They're taking little micro second snapshots of information and storing it away in thin, say, for example, like if you're slicing up toast, it's like, those are really thin slices. But when you smoke weed or say for, you know, take mushrooms, the brain tends to blink less. So you're taking in more information. So that information is getting distributed in bigger doses. So I just found that, I don't know. I found that fascinating. But anyway, I'll wrap it up here for you. But I wanted to, but while I was researching all this, you know, I had this recollection I had when I was really small in regard to drugs, and I was watching Fat Albert. And Fat Albert, of course, the host was Bill Cosby. Yes, that Bill Cosby, the rapist. And what was funny, you know, America's Dad on the Cosby Show, I distinctly remember him saying, because the episode was about drugs and how all the, you know, Fat Albert and the gang, you know, Weird Donald, like the dude with like the hat over his head, like that guy was on drugs, you know that. But he goes, so Bill Cosby, okay, in his narration, you know, intermittently between the cartoon, between the Fat Albert sections, would have his own little, you know, he'd start ruminating on this, that, and the other. And I remember him saying, what a fucking hypocrite this guy was. He goes, one way to tell that you're on drugs, my wife Camille. No, he didn't. He goes, one way to tell when you're on drugs is you open up the palm of your hand. And if your hand's shaking, you're on drugs. I'm like, oh, fuck. What? Like, I'm sure you could find this. I'm sure you could find this sequence on YouTube somewhere. So the way he talks about this, I looked at my hand. So, and I'm probably like 9 years old, eight or 9 years old. I'm looking at my hand, and my hand's shaking a little. I'm like, oh my God, I might be on drugs. Oh, fuck, I'm on drugs. But that was how America's Dad, the rapist, determined that whether or not you're using drugs. My determination is, if you like the Grateful Dead. Anyway, that's the podcast for today, folks. I'll talk at you later. Love you all. Arrivederci, babies. Wait a minute. Hold on. Hipsters. That's what I was trying to remember. Hipsters. The perfect blend of redneck and hippie. Am I right? I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, I also forgot. I forgot my whacked out movie pick of the weekend. It's kind of like an opposite whack out pick. Go see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's the perfect, it's really like one, it's a perfect movie. It was, it swept the Academy Awards in 75. It's got epic performances by Jack Nicholson and Louise Fletcher as Randall Patrick McMurphy, R.P. McMurphy, R.P.M., revving it up. And Louise Fletcher, evil nurse Ratchet, crushing the inmates, making them conform, you know, turning these poor, sad saps who society has cast away because they're different, because they don't act right, all converged into this mental asylum in 1975 Oregon. Phenomenal pick. But that is my non-whacked out pick of the week. Go indulge yourself. It's a brilliant performance. One of the greats of Nicholson's. And he's got some great ones. I mean, you know, Jesus, The Shining, Chinatown, Easy Rider, Witches of Eastwick even. Give him a little credit for that one. But One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. One flew east, one flew west, and one flew over the cuckoo's nest. Run it today, boys and girls. Love y'all. That is the podcast. That is the Pizzodcast. So I'm done. I'm out of here. So love y'all. Talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.